Good evening to you, and welcome to the show, History and You, with George Rodriguez Walling.
Good evening, and welcome to the show, History and You, the show where you decide what history becomes. I am your host, George Rodriguez Walling, and I'm very happy to be here with you this evening. If you want to call in and contribute your thoughts, please do so at toll-free, 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Call me, please, and tell me your views. If not, send me an email at historyandyou@yahoo.com. That's historyandyou@yahoo.com. You can also find me on the web on www.bbsradio.com/historyandyou. That's bbsradio.com/historyandyou. Please visit my website and leave me a blog in the Fast Chat or Message Me sections of the webpage. Tell me what's on your mind. I would also ask you to help me sustain the show by keeping it going on a weekly basis through your generous donations. There is a donate button on the webpage for you to easily contribute. Please be generous. Your contribution to the show is a very, very special help to me. Thank you. And I look forward to reading your blog. Tonight's show is brought to you by the folks at FX Software and Sweet Pea Women's Apparel by Stacy Friday. Tonight's topic is the second part of Bias in the Classroom, Bias in the Classroom Part 2. Welcome to the second part of our two-part series on Bias in the Classroom with my guest, Dr. James Miller, retired professor from UCLA. Welcome back to the show, James.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be back.
James, last week we were talking about how we've both experienced bias in the classroom and in the field of education at large throughout our respective careers, but never, ever has it been more punctuated than when you see students and professors alike as the products and the catalysts of bias in our society. Do you have any reactions or anything that you can relate in relation to what you've seen in terms of bias throughout the years?
Well, not specifically. I was more interested in what you have seen and what you had experienced throughout your career. We didn't really get into that last week. And I thought this would be a good opportunity to get your perspective, your experience on the subject.
Right. Well, I'll tell you a couple of things that have left me, pretty dry throughout the years. First of all, much of it was expressed in my narrative last week on bias in the classroom. But to paraphrase somewhat the essence of that narrative, it's been in the behavior and the gestures of teachers in showing a particular penchant and wanting to influence their students to go a certain way. I've seen that so many times over the years that it's really left me with a severe disappointment in terms of what teachers do. I, as a teacher, have always gone out of my way and then some to make sure that students are always surrounded, if not inundated, with choices and alternatives, various points of views to consider, to view, to decide. It's sort of like when you go to a banquet and you find this long, long table full of all sorts of foods and fruits and just about everything that your mind can imagine. And you can sit any place in the table and you can eat any item of food you want and you can have as much as you want. And only you know how much you can eat. Only you know what you like. Only you know what you don't like. So in other words, what I'm trying to say is that when you are given so many liberties, from that perspective. The student walks away, I would like to think, with a more positive image of the choices granted to that student than having a teacher or someone say, no, eat this more than that, or eat. Now, granted, you can always end up eating the wrong foods one too many times and it's not good for you. We all understand that. But within reason, within the idea of finding balance, I think that's very important.
Well, have you found that you have not, as a teacher or even as a student in your graduate program, not been treated with the option of being exposed to different opinions and having different opinions acceptable by your teachers?
Well, as a teacher, I have found, James, to be more free, with greater liberty, with a greater sense of latitude to do or to say whatever I feel is absolutely necessary as a teacher in schools. In the school I work at presently, it's a very good school in allowing you to project students, mold their future direction in a very uncluttered, undisturbed way, because the school already knows me, what I stand for, and so therein goes along with the ride an element of trust. However, my experience as a graduate student at the graduate level, even starting to do or look into certain postgraduate work, I have found much more bias in that area than I ever did in teaching. In the materials that you choose to write about, the way that you write about it, the topics you bring into class, I remember doing coursework, how you bring out these topics in class discussion, how people and the professor respond to you in all of these ways. I found that to be very cloistered, not feeling free to express what you feel is pertinent and important. And of course, when you come to the level of doing comprehensive exams at the PhD level, I can't tell you how careful you have to be in how you write and develop arguments in your essays, because if it's tilted way too much toward a side or an angle that the professors are finding themselves to be vehemently or diametrically opposed to, you're really rolling dice there. The same thing with an oral exam, and also from what I've heard from so many people who have already gone through that experience, how you express a point, how you develop an argument, I think is very, very important in relation to the kind of listeners that you have, that you've put before you to evaluate what you can do and how you can think out an argument, the stock that you've put in the selection of professors that you've chosen. So at that level, I've seen so much more bias that serves only to truncate you in an awful lot of ways. And as far as freedom to think and in the field of education, in that perspective, I found it to be very, very cluttered.
Well, what I hear you saying is kind of part and parcel of graduate school. When you were admitted as a master's student or a PhD student, there is usually people who specialize in certain theories, certain methodology, and they're there to, quote, train you in those theories and methodology from their point of view. And yes, if you don't adhere to or accept their point of view, then the question is, why should they train you? You need to be trained by someone else.
Yeah, well, you see, that whole premise I find a problem with. I find a problem with that premise because education should be a little bit more balanced and find more freedom in that process. I don't think that just because they are trained in a certain area does not entitle them now to suffocate your point of view. Do you see where I'm coming from?
I can see definitely where you're coming from. Having been there, both as a graduate student and as a professor training graduate students for master's and PhDs, yes. But if we're talking about bias in the classroom, and particularly from the teacher's point of view, yes, you're going to encounter that at the graduate level. Hopefully, not to the point where it's detrimental. Hopefully, yes, you will find a variety of orientations that you can pick from or mesh together and come out with something that more represents what you think, feel, how you should be trained, how you should be treated in the process, and et cetera. That is, and I'm not apologizing for this, nor am I condoning it in terms of how graduate programs tend to work. There's a lot of egos, and you found this to be very true. A lot of walk on water type egos.
Yes.
And my way or the highway egos.
Yeah, and that's specifically what I'm targeting, specifically. And it's so pervasive, James. It is so pervasive that there's almost no way out of it.
Yeah. You know, I mentioned last week to you that the bias that I ran into was more at the student level in college, high school, but not in K through 12, yes, but in college from freshman year all the way up through PhD, the comps, the orals, the presentation of the dissertation, et cetera. I mean, all the way through. Some of it was almost devastating. And it was something that I had to deal with. I fought in many cases to the point where I changed programs, changed schools, and et cetera. But it was part and parcel of the experience.
Yeah.
And we talked last week about, we're talking here professional bias on the part of the teacher, if it's K through 12, or on the part of the professor, if it's undergraduate, graduate school.
Right.
And we're talking a clash of possible personalities between student and professor.
Right.
We clash between discipline perspectives and the student and the professor. So it's, to me, what you're talking about, you know, what you're experiencing, a lot of personal bias that fades into professional bias.
Yeah.
And what role, if any, excuse me, should that happen?
Well, James, let me interject here at this point, because there are two things that I think is important at this juncture to bring out. Number one, when we're talking about bias, what I have emphasized the most, in other words, what I have found to be the most morally egregious to me, has been the fact that in the K through 12 area, ninth graders, even eighth graders, ninth graders, 10th graders, and up to a certain extent, 11th graders, you're talking about a young mind. You're talking about a young kid who is still very impressionable by teachers whose atmosphere created by the teacher they identify with the most. I mean, to the extent that entourages many times are formed around these teachers, or if not, just let me come out and say it plainly, a cult of students begins to develop around this single teacher, okay? When we're talking about bias at the university level or more open within the professional area of the in the field of education, we're talking about adults here, graduate school. We're talking about adults. We're talking about big boys and girls here. And if there is bias out there, which I believe very firmly that there is, and I think that you believe similarly, yet as adults, we know how to use the device to filter in and out certain things, to be selective. We know how to be selective, when to be selective. We know how to discern certain things, okay, because we are adults. But what I find more morally outraging is that an adult who knows better as a professional teacher is influencing this young mind who is not as well trained in the ways of the world as an adult in graduate school would be. It's a kid that is putting his entire belief and trust in someone else, and that someone else is influencing too much, perhaps in the wrong way or direction, a young mind. That's what I find more disturbing than anything else, okay? But along those lines, this is, I think, limited to academic bias, okay? But for me, bias also opens up to many other areas. And let me just touch upon this one and have you respond to this to see if you agree or disagree up to a certain point or not. Bias can also be found in the way that educators, and I want to use the word educators here to describe not only K-12 teachers, instructors, but also professors, assistant professors, adjunct instructors, and so on down the line. Everyone involved in the field of education that find themselves teaching in a classroom, even TAs, teacher assistants, okay? I think that the field of education has found itself to enabling students way too much, coddling students way too much, being permissive to students way too much. If students need extra time because in doing a test or an exam or an essay or whatever, accommodations are made way too many. And you know what? Students are milking it for everything they've got. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't cases out there that deserve and merit and need that extra accommodations because of natural limitations they may have. I'm talking about how teachers and instructors and professors sometimes have become so nurturing, overly nurturing, that it is crippling the proper moral education of a student. Response.
Wow, that's a mouthful. Because if I understand what you're saying, the role of the educator has drifted too far to the side of being a nurturer.
Oh, absolutely. And that's not the way to educate. My God, James, I remember things I've always wanted. But my parents, thank God, always told me, you want it, you have to work hard for it. And once you do, it's okay to want certain things. If you've really put your mind to working toward that goal, I think we're living in a society where we are becoming a class of educators. We call ourselves educators, but we're really becoming more enablers than anything else. Enablers in extra time, enablers in, excuses, I can't come today because of this. You know, it wasn't that long ago when I found myself needing to differentiate the difference between a reason and an excuse. And I asked this to students, what's the difference? And the students knew right away. A reason is based on fact and circumstances that are out of your control many times, not always, but many times, enough times. An excuse is when you are fabricating a reason to cover up something or to compensate for some kind of an inadequacy. And so many people out there, even teachers and professors, haven't really taken time to think clearly about what the difference is between an excuse and a reason. Excuse being that you are fabricating a collection of reasons not based on fact or circumstances completely to cover up for some kind of an inadequacy, some kind of an absent-mindedness, some kind of a recklessness or personal negligence on your side. That's an excuse. And teachers provide the venues to allow students to create excuses. And anyone who was listening to me out there, anyone from driving in a car to going home to being home listening to their laptops, or whatever, they will have to inevitably come full circle to realizing that to a large enough extent, to a dangerously enough extent, I'm right.
Again, a mouthful. I don't subscribe to teachers as not nurturing. I believe wholeheartedly that teachers should be nurturers. My mother was my first teacher, and she worked with me, I guess, to what we would call today a form of homeschooling. I went from age 4, my first year before kindergarten, all the way through into middle school, where the subject matter was beyond what she had learned, and et cetera. She was my nurturer and helped me learn and all the whole things. I had many teachers who were nurturers. Now, myself, I agree with you to the extent that, yes, there should be and there must be a line drawn between nurturing and what you call coddling. When I was teaching, and particularly my years at UCLA, I would start all my classes, and I would tell my students, the syllabus outlines what you should be reading, when the tests are going to be, papers, when they're due, and et cetera. I do not accept late papers. I don't give makeup exams. I accept no excuses. Oh, wait a minute, I do. There's one excuse. You died. Not just died. You died on the way to my class to turn in your paper or take the exam. That is the only excuse I'll accept.
Yeah.
Other than that, there's no excuses. Students were angry at me. I now remember some went to the department chair because I wouldn't give a makeup exam or I wouldn't take a paper from them late and et cetera. And I told them at the very beginning of the class, these are the requirements. This is who I am as a professor. This is the way I'm going to do things. In turn, I will give you as much time as you need, office hours, beyond office hours. I will work with any area that you have problems with. I'll go beyond the call of duty. I'll go the distance individually, collectively, to help you get an understanding of what it is I'm teaching and want you to learn, and et cetera. But you, in turn, will have to do the work. No cheating. No copying from someone else. No plagiarism, and et cetera.
Yeah.
I laid it all out, and I adhere to it. I was so strict with it that students would call my house, and at the time I was married, and talk to my wife and ask them to please intervene on their behalf to get me to take a late paper or give a makeup exam, and et cetera, and I wouldn't do it. But I also was probably the most nurturing prof in the department.
Well, you know, it's those kinds of conditions, steadfast conditions, that students will probably remember you the most, and probably in a positive light. I have another interesting insight on bias that I want to share with you and the audience as well. An experience that I found while I was teaching at the university level. But first, let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back to discuss Bias in the Classroom Part 2 on History and You in just a moment. Just to break it down. We build it up just to break it down.
In a world dominated by frameworks, platforms, and tools, it's difficult to know how to win when the only certainty is change. At Software FX, customer service and highly useful products are our main goals. Over 20 years of experience, coupled with ideas and inspiration from more than 150,000 developers all over the world, have turned into business intelligence tools that provide more choice, convenience, and value to our customers and partners. Yes, technologies do change, but Software FX has your back. That's Software FX, data visualization for every need, every platform. Call us today, toll free, at 1-800-392-4278. That's 1-800-392-4278. Be the master of your data. Software FX. Sweet Pea by Stacey Frotte is a woman's contemporary clothing line and nationally recognized brand. Sweet Pea is an innovative collection that pairs flirtiness with sensibility. Our Sweet Pea woman can be running a board meeting, watching a soccer game, or dining out with friends. Sweet Pea is recognized to be eye-catching and edgy. We empower our loyal worldwide customer base by creating clothing that fits their lifestyle. She is on the move and believes that Sweet Pea is her go-to on almost all occasions. Day into night, Sweet Pea's stylish blouses move with you and your busy day. Bloomingdale's, Nordstrom's, Anthropologie, and the Sweet Pea by Stacey Frotte website feature new Sweet Pea designs weekly. We have been creating beautiful clothing for 16 years, and there is no sign of us slowing down. Fashion is cyclical, it is true, but style is a constant. Please visit www.sweetpeabystaceyfrotte.com today.
Okay, and we are back discussing the topic for this evening's show, Bias in the Classroom, Part 2 on History and You, with Dr. James Miller. James, I came across a situation at the university level that was, at the moment when it happened, it was surprising, but thinking back, I shouldn't have been so surprised at all after teaching for so many years. And let me begin to discuss this one situation on bias from a different perspective. Life is not so much what you make it, but life is what makes you. life happens to you. And what happens to you throughout life is arbitrary. It has its own agenda. It has its own fate and destiny, and it will make designs on you more often than you make designs on it. So if you are growing into from a child to a young adult to a fuller adult, you are moving throughout stages in this thing called life, which has a certain way about itself. Oftentimes it's referred to as the way of the world. And the way of the world oftentimes is not kind. It's not easy. And in order to educate our younger folks a little bit better, perhaps more effectively, sometimes a good educator will have to take on the courage and take on the moral force in knowing that what you do or what you do not do for a youngster is for his or her own good. I cannot tell you enough, James, with this as a short prelude, I can't tell you how often teachers are afraid or are reluctant to fail a student for poor work, specifically giving an F to a student that hands in a poor product. For fear or for inconvenience or not going through the inconvenience of having to deal with parents, having to deal with the explanation to explain to parents why the student did so bad in this project, in this essay, in this short answer, whatever it be. They don't take the trouble to see it through, or they're just afraid of some kind of a backlash, be it coming from the university department chair or coming from the administration in a K-12 institution or coming from parents or a combination. Who knows? I had a student, and here is my short story, that I was teaching at the university here in Miami some years back, and I assigned an essay. This one student wrote horrible. And I can't tell you, James, how poorly many of the students out there write. They don't know how to write. They from the simple form of sentence structure, expression, syntax, punctuation, everything, they're horrible. Okay. Well, this one student wrote a piece on in a course that I was teaching on government, basic government, and I failed him. Student approaches me after I hand out all the papers and asks why I failed him. And at first I started telling him, well, you did very poorly in the way you developed the argument, the way you lined up all your points. Many times it's a bunch of hot air, BS. You know, you spoke much more rhetoric than you did linking facts with projecting an argument. You didn't do any, and I went on and on pointing paragraph by paragraph by paragraph what he did wrong. At the end of all my explanations, and this was already when class was over, so there was time to discuss with the student. At the end, this kid tells me, so your conclusion, Mr. Walling, is that I'm a retard. And I said, no, it's not about you being a retard. It's much more about someone never telling you what you should have been told and instructed years ago, whether it was in 8th grade or 9th grade or 10th grade or 11th grade or 12th grade. And no teacher wanted to take the trouble, wanted to go through the time, wanted to go through the work of showing you. And so what began to take over was a bias that basically tells other students as a message putting it out there that, hey, you know what? As long as you give me a semblance or some kind of a gesture that you're writing, and if you write a lot, it's okay. Well, it's not okay because it has its drawbacks and serious consequences down the road. Or if not, teachers then will become more nurturing and enabling unnecessarily. And by the way, you said something earlier about your parents or your mom being nurturing. There is, I think there's a big difference here between nurturing as a young child and being guided along the way very closely, monitored, as opposed to already a high school junior or senior as a young adult still being nurtured unnecessarily. Instead of nurturing a sense of individuality, they begin to nurture more and more of a sense of dependence. And that's dangerous, and it has future consequences, even to the point of feeling psychologically defeated. Like this one student told me, well, then your conclusion has to be that I'm a retard. No, it's not that you're a retard. It's because you haven't been taught to think more structurally, more factually, in a more organized way.
George, I hear a lot of things in that last story of yours. Let me try and do two or three things here quickly. I hear, especially in K through 12, where teachers are put under pressure to pass all students, whether or not they are ready or not for the next level, or they've comprehended enough at their level to be passed on to the next level. And yes, where they have principals, parents, the whole structure pressuring teachers. I mean, it's almost required in some places that you do not hold a student back, or, God forbid, a whole lot of students out of a given class back. Okay, that's, if that's a bias, that's not a necessarily a teacher bias. That's a structural bias. That's a structural bias that if you don't adhere to, yes, you will be called on the carpet. Yes, you could lose your job, and et cetera. So placing the teacher at the fault for this, I think, and this is my view, is you misplacing it on the wrong person. It's the structure of the system, whether that's correct or not. I don't happen to agree with that. And at the college level, the same thing. I can cite two examples readily. One, I think, was a freshman class. Young lady came to class every day, sat in the front row. She was as pleasant, as nice as I've ever had a student be. When it came down to taking the test and writing the short paper, it was awful. Totally awful. And on that particular exam, I gave her an F. She came to office hours, and the first thing she said was, but I came to class every day. And I realized what she was saying was, in high school, middle school, elementary school, coming to class every day was more than sufficient to justify you passing me. And I had to explain to her, for me, no. You need to be able to do the work and do it at a certain level, or I'm going to fail you. I don't give courtesy D's and C's, A's and B's. You have to do the work. Now, there were many, many students coming in as freshmen, sophomores, who were not prepared for college-level work. It was an epidemic. Second story, honor class. And I was teaching honor class in criminal justice studies. I was a professor in the department at that time. And this, most of the kids in the class were honor students in criminal justice, juniors, seniors. They were going to go into law enforcement, what have you. This was an honors class. The guy wrote a paper. It was so awful.
I chewed him out.
I chewed him out for having the audacity to give me such a paper.
Exactly.
It was so awful. I chewed him out. He was, I think, maybe 23, 24, 25 years old, senior. But then I told him I would work with him on his paper, and that in my view, he should be his own worst critic. He should have higher standards, and he should always strive to be the best, do his best. And what he had turned into me was nowhere near that standard. And I did. I worked with him for the rest of the quarter. He turned it around. He ended up getting an A.
Yeah.
10 years later, let me finish this. This is the crack-up part for me. 10 years later, I meet this guy at a social event, and he comes up to me and he says to me, "Are you Dr. Miller?" And I looked at him. I recognized him. I said, "Yes." And he said to me in front of the whole table full of people, "I had to tell you, you changed my life."
Good for you.
"Because of you," he went on to say, "he went to graduate school, he got his master's, he is performing well at his job and his career, he's moving up the career ladder, all because of what he and I did together after I chewed him out for being such a non-performing student." I'm trying to be very polite here, etc.
Yeah, good. Good for you. It means that you and I, James, are anachronisms because we seem to be occupying less and less of a useful role in the kind of world that education is trying to put out there. You know, you said something a moment ago about in your first story about the teacher. It's not so much the teacher in relation to the bias involved. It you said it was the structure. And what I think you meant, correct me if I'm wrong, please, but what I think you might have wanted to say within that particular context was that it's an institutional bias by way of a structure. Am I correct in that? Okay.
Yeah.
Then if it is an institutional bias, which I completely agree with, by the way, okay, the teacher is part of it. The teacher is not working autonomously, divorced from that institution. That teacher is very much a part of that institutional mindset. And within that mindset comes that institutional bias, which I completely agree with you, is very much there, very much dismissive to any and all criticisms, very much pervasive. It's a real educational hegemony that predominates fatly sitting on any and all challenges to that kind of authority. Okay? And I just wanted to expand on that a little bit more, which is what I think you were trying to express as an institutional bias. But that teacher is very much a part of it. Okay? And the teacher that decides not to be a part of it is risking, you know what, their job. Teachers know, they know what is the right and the wrong thing to do. They just need a paycheck. And many times they're not about to put that on the table so that somebody can interpret that as, oh, this teacher is biting the hand that feeds him. Do you see what I'm saying?
Well, again, George, I agree with part of your assessment of what I was saying, and I don't agree with other parts of it. In my own words, what I'm saying is, if we talk about a classroom, an individual classroom, one among 20, 30, 40 other classrooms at that school or that university, yes, there are going to be biases inside that classroom. If you've got 30 students and a teacher, you're probably going to have 31 different source of bias. If you've got textbooks, you got bias. If you have teacher with different backgrounds and experiences, you're going to have bias. What I'm directly saying is there are many, many, multiple sources of bias in every classroom. Whether the teacher bias should prevail, whether individual students or groups of students bias should prevail, or textbook, curriculum even, all sorts of bias, school boards, their bias.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I agree with what you're saying to a certain extent. I do agree with very much. There is that bias. My argument is, can we try and keep that bias at as much of a minimum as possible? Because you know what I have even seen bias do in the classroom is a student comes in, and in coming into the classroom, students come in with their bias, not born from themselves because they haven't lived in life long enough to acquire a bias based on experience. So where does this bias come from? By way of an attitude that's manifested on the part of students from their own parents. And so you have the parent bias being expressed through their sons and daughters in the classroom on the one hand. And on the other hand, you have an entirely different attitude rooted on another bias on the part of the teacher. And so you have one bias struggling against another bias. Well, I stand there like a referee on the sidelines watching this ball game proceed. And I ask myself, what has happened to a more noble purpose to the classroom? What has happened to seeing more facts and truth within a classroom than an egotistical struggle of two biases at odds with each other, vying for who predominates more in relation to their bias? That's my disappointment. That's the very kernel of my argument. Can we do something about that incredibly prostituted and adulterated bias that is getting in the way of a more pure and a more noble purpose for teaching? That's what my claim is staked on.
And I understand that, and I agree with a lot of it, and I'll refer back to what I said last week in terms of what is, I'll put it another way, the purpose of education. Since the classroom is the place where education takes place, what is the purpose of education? What is the role of the teacher in trying to reach that purpose?
Yes.
You have then all the external visions of what the education should be, what the purpose should be. You come into the classroom, you have a conflict of visions. Even the students who don't realize what their visions of education is and how it should take place, et cetera, yes, they may be mouthing what their parents have said it should be, and et cetera. You have all of that. And it's the teacher, in my view, as a teacher, my vision prevails.
Yeah. Yeah.
I come in. I'm prepared. I'm very good at what I do. I want to get this over to you. I want to get you to think critically, make judgments using your own logic, understanding, the ability to critically look at information coming from all different directions, and to assemble it all, connect the dots, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's what I want to do. Now, if I don't do it because I'm pushed or pulled by students or parents or administration, then I'm not doing my job as a teacher.
Yeah, yeah. And I agree with that very much. Yeah.
I won't stand for that from the teacher, from the other teachers, from parents, from students themselves. So your question is, one question would be, I don't think you're ever going to have a classroom without bias.
That's true.
So it's who's biased and how you deal with that bias.
Well, that's why I'm saying to try and minimize it as much as possible to allow other things in the classroom to take place. But do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, and when you are the lone ranger wanting to go one way or bias neutral, and you're up against a system and its individual parts, it's going to be tough sledding. And that's what I hear you saying. It's been tough sledding.
Yeah, but let me tell you that I'm not vanilla when it comes to education. I know what I stand for. And it is precisely this whole argument of bias that I don't want my personal view getting in the way, even though I understand that all these things, bias is always going to be there because everything is biased, everything around you, everything is biased, of course, but it's the idea of keeping it at an all-time low. Let me conclude this because we're rather rapidly running out of time. I want to get in one or two more things here, but that's really all the time we have for now. But now that we've come to that final part of our show where I always want to leave you with a final thought to consider and to further reflect. But before I do that, I want to thank my guest for this evening, Dr. James Miller. James, thank you so much for sharing two shows with my audience out there. Your insights, your experience are valuable beyond any realistic realm. And I guess you would have to live out those years to really understand what I've just said. Thank you so very much for donating so generously your time and your interest and your thoughts. I really appreciate it very, very much. And I understand you have a show coming up very quickly. You want to tell us about it?
Yes, it's The War on Public Education, where I'm going to lay out the who, the what, the why, the how, the where, the nature of this war, and what the goals and objectives of the war, which is, in a nutshell, to destroy public education and erect privatized education, one system developed by corporate interests as opposed to the public good interest, and to explore that and try and explain that and make it understandable.
Good. And I understand you're having a show on it on BBS Radio, so hopefully your audience will start listening to what seems to be a very, very interesting debut as to your thoughts on that topic. Some final thoughts, very quickly. The classroom, it's a place where students as young adults begin to think. Let's not compromise the only hope they have to find truth and balance in everything they experience in life. Everyone puts their own spin on everything, we know, but let's find a good enough reason to put limits on our egos and ambitions to smother individuality and rot it into the image of ourselves. I'd like to leave you, or start leaving all of you, with a proverb by Victor Hugo. The supreme happiness of life is the conviction that we are loved. Join me again next Tuesday night at 8 p.m. for another hour of insight by visiting my website at bbsradio.com/historyandyou. In your blog, leave me something to think about, please. As always, I want to thank the folks at BBS Radio, my promoter and producers, Deborah, Doug, and Don, for making this show possible and for all of the things you guys do to bring the show to our audience every week. Also, please remember to generously donate a contribution to our show. Your financial participation is really a very valuable help for me. Thank you so much in advance. As your host for this evening's show, this is George Rodriguez Walling, wishing for all of you a very, very pleasant evening. Good night.